We do not have a quorum today, as you can see, so this will be a subcommittee of the subcommittee for the purpose of taking this informational testimony. Thank you so much for being here. We are expecting Representative Greenlick to join us at some point, and Representative Bruin may be able to come. The other members will not be able to be here today. First on the agenda for this informational meeting, we have an update and review of nursing shortage initiatives in Oregon today. And the Oregon Center of Nursing, we have, I believe, four people here, and we have four chairs. It may be a little bit cozy, but if Susan King, Judith Baggs, Karen Burke, and Judith Woodruff would like to come forward, please. Thank you, and I will let you decide who will go first, and please remember to state your name for the record. Thank you for being here.
I think that's my cue, I guess, to get started. Good afternoon. My name is Judith Woodruff, and I'm a program director for nursing at the Northwest Health Foundation, and I'm here today to give somewhat of a perspective of the Northwest Health Foundation, who's been a constant funder of nursing shortage initiatives in the last few years, some our perspective on the shortage and where the initiatives have gone. In 2001, the Northwest Health Foundation created a report on the nursing shortage. It's been around for a while. It's called a public health crisis in the making, and it was the first report that was issued in Oregon that addressed the need for nurses in different all across the board, and also gave us the first place where the data had all been collected together to address the nursing shortage. The report identified that there were complex causes of the shortage that had not been seen before. It's what we would refer to as sort of a the perfect storm that was about to be brewing, that included the reasons for the shortage included the retirement of experienced nurses. Most of the nurses in the state of Oregon, the average age is over the age of 47, and so retirement is looming for many of them, and certainly a possibility in the next 5 to 10 years. The other issues that have contributed to the shortage have included an increase in the demand for complex health care. That's been brought about by the demographic changes of the patient population, both an aging population and a more ethnically and racially diverse group. It's also been due to complex disease processes around chronic disease management and other needs of patients in the patient care mix. So there's been a change to the demand for healthcare services that are provided by nurses. There's also been a decrease in the supply of nurses available to meet the needs, including a decline in enrollment in nursing schools that was happening up until the mid to late 90s. There is others here can talk to you about the faculty situation and the other issues with regards to the nursing education initiatives. But for some time, there was actually a decline in nursing enrollment. As that began to turn around and there has been more interest in applying for nursing school, there's been a bottleneck at those schools because they were reduced in number and size for some period of time, and then now as students want to enter nursing, the spaces are not available for them, and the clinical opportunities that they need in order to complete nursing school are not available to them. The Northwest Health Foundation began our work with the report in 2001, and we also supported the Oregon Nurse Leadership Council to come together and develop a strategy for the state of Oregon. I believe the strategic plan is in the packets that have been provided to you. We trusted that the ONLC, which is a group of five organizations, had the expertise and the drive to come up with a strategic plan that would be workable, would be focused on the right issues, and would provide some statewide strategic plan to address the shortages that were looming. In 2003, Northwest Health Foundation created a five-year initiative to fund nursing shortage projects and programs. And in that time, we have supported well over $3.5 million in nursing shortage initiative projects. That's been quite varied in the 4.5 years that we've been doing that, everything from nursing education, capacity building, leadership initiatives, and diversity projects that were very important to us. And at this point, in addition, of course, for us, was support of the Oregon Center for Nursing, which was a key piece of the strategic plan. When we took a look at the strategic plan in 2003, we noticed that there were places where the Northwest Health Foundation could have an impact, and there were places where it was probably less likely we would have an impact. And so we chose the places where we felt there was some long-term investment possibilities that would result in something even after our funding was discontinued. The Oregon Center for Nursing is one of those projects. The Oregon Consortium for Nursing Education is one of the largest projects that we have funded, well over $600,000, I think, at this point we've provided to the consortium. The goal of our initiative is to address as much of the strategic plan as we're able to, both by supporting projects that we've funded that are demonstration projects or strategic renovation of education and other things, but also to build the infrastructure of the nursing leadership in order to carry on this work even after our funding is decreased. The work that's being done in Oregon, you should know, is being watched by the nation. Oregon is a leader in both nursing education and in nursing workforce development. There are a series of initiatives within national nursing workforce centers. There are about 30 of them in the United States, and they're all watching Oregon for the successes that come here through the Oregon model. We are often referred to as the Oregon model. We think there are probably a number of models that we're developing and supporting here. I think the most important piece of the information that you should know about the shortage and the initiatives that are in response to that are the fact that the collaboration between the nurse leadership and hospitals, foundations, and others is phenomenal. And it's something which needs to be recognized by the state, in that other states and other organizations view the collaborative spirit of these nurses and their leaders as something that's truly remarkable, something that other states are still trying to get to the collaboration before they start dealing with the shortage issues. So I always want to commend the nurses for their the trust that they place in each other in developing the solutions to the shortage. As a foundation, we have always believed that our role is in supporting what they want to do to make it work, that our role is not to direct them, but is to really give them the support and the information and the funding that they need to complete the work that's at hand.
Thank you very much. Are there questions for Ms. Woodruff?
I can ask you questions in a different context.
Thank you very much. I have a question about, you talked about how the nation is watching Oregon, and I look forward to seeing Oregon once again be a leader in another area. And I wonder how Oregon compares with other states in terms of the shortage. Where are we compared with not only our neighbors, but states across the country?
Well, that's interesting, because as part of what I do with the Northwest Health Foundation, I'm also the national program director for a project called Partners Investing in Nursing's Future, which is a partnership with the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation to develop statewide and regional initiatives around the nursing shortage. We currently have 10 grantees or 10 partners, and we're developing 10 more. Every state in the country is facing the same problem. Some of them are facing more serious problems in different fields, in the sense of, say, long-term care is a bigger problem for them because they have more elderly and retired citizens. Some of them are facing more problems in the rural areas because they are very rural states that have even fewer population centers than even Oregon does. But in general, the shortages of nurses are across the board. The responses to those shortages are different. And so the states that are working on these things are working towards the same goals, but often with different approaches, and certainly not with the level of collaboration and working together that we see here in Oregon. But basically, the shortages exist all over the country in pretty much the same numbers.
Thank you.
And Chair, may I come?
Absolutely, Representative Greenlee.
I just want to say how proud I am of the work that Judith's done. I'm a board member of the Northwest Health Foundation, have been since it founded, and we all talk about the nursing shortage now. In 2007, everybody talks about it, everybody knows. And you say nursing shortage, and everybody nods their head and understands a little bit, although we're not all sure what to do about it. But when Judith really began this pioneering work about 2000, right? So, I mean, this was not on everybody's tongue, and the stuff she's done, and the brave stuff that the nursing leaders that work with her have done really has made this an issue that, yeah, it's a problem. Now, what are we going to do about it? I mean, we don't need to spend too much time anymore, because it's just the work they've done have made it very clear it's a problem, and a huge problem, and we really need to get to work on it, and I've been very proud of
Thank you.
All their work in this.
Thank you, Representative Greenlick. Anybody ready to go next?
Sure.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Karen Burke, and I'm the education consultant for the Oregon State Board of Nursing. In that role, I deal with nursing education programs all over the state for RN and practical nursing education. And so I wanted to tell you a little bit about how education programs have responded to the shortage. And since the report came out in 2001 and the nursing leaders started to work together, you have the data that I'm going to talk to in front of you, so I won't go into much about numbers. But basically, in terms of practical nursing programs, that's one of the places we've seen the biggest change in nursing education. In the year 2000, most practical nursing programs were the first year, well, all practical nursing programs were the first year of an associate degree nursing program. What this resulted in was very few graduates who actually stayed as practical nurses and practiced as practical nurses. Many more who continued on to the second year and went into the associate degree to become registered nurses. Over the course of the last 6 years, the number of associate degree programs with a practical nursing option has decreased, but at the same time, we've added a number of new standalone practical nursing programs, which will admit students who may not be competitive for an associate degree program, reduces the competition for the community college and university nursing programs, and we hope will significantly increase the supply of practical nurses in Oregon. Don't have the data yet to show that this is working, because the first program down at Rogue Community College in Medford has just graduated 3 classes, and so there's not enough graduates yet to say what an impact they have shown. And the first class up in the Portland metro area just graduated in December. So we don't yet have the data to show what that's going to do. In terms of the associate degree programs, which all are held at community colleges in Oregon, there has been one additional associate degree program added to the state, and that is on the Oregon coast to serve the needs of students enrolled in the mid-Oregon coast. It's located in Newport and Lincoln City. In 2006, 4 community colleges joined with OHSU to become part of the Oregon Consortium for Nursing Education, or as we call it, OCNE. You'll see that acronym in your handout. These folks are offering a baccalaureate curriculum with an option to exit with licensure at the RN level and at the associate degree, but the hope is that the majority of students will continue on to complete the baccalaureate degree, and we will be preparing a better prepared workforce standard and meet the needs of Oregon healthcare in the future. In terms of baccalaureate nursing programs, not only has OHSU worked very closely with community colleges on development of the OCNE curriculum and the consortium, but we have added 2 new baccalaureate nursing programs in the state in the last 3 years. And in fact, Ron Mitchell in the audience is the director of the new nursing program at George Fox University, which will graduate its first class of students in April of 2008. So we're looking forward to these new graduates of new programs coming in. In terms of nursing enrollment, what has happened over the last 5 years in response to the shortage and the work of nursing leaders is that, as I said, in practical nursing, we really don't see a big change yet. We will see. But in terms of registered nursing programs, community colleges have increased their enrollment by more than 250% since the year 2001. So that's a huge increase. Baccalaureate programs have increased their enrollment by 67%. Again, a very large increase in enrollment. This has put more pressure on clinical facilities for clinical placements, certainly has put more pressure on finding adequately prepared nursing faculty to fill the positions needed to educate these graduates. And I had one more point, and it's gone out of my brain.
Absolutely.
Oh, sometimes that happens. In terms of nursing faculty, this is a major concern, as I said, because of the increased number of programs. We have something like 50 total programs in the state compared to 33 that we had initially. These are all competing for the same group of master's prepared nursing faculty or highly prepared baccalaureate prepared nursing faculty for practical nursing programs. In the year 2001, we had a ratio of one nursing faculty to every 3.6 nursing students enrolled in the state. By 2005, that ratio was one nursing faculty to every 5.2 nursing students enrolled in the state. What this has resulted in is that we have more faculty who are very new to the faculty role. We have more faculty who are less prepared than what they used to be. Schools are able to appoint nursing or to apply to the Board of Nursing to appoint a faculty member who does not meet the educational requirements under a couple criteria. We have more schools applying for these exceptions to the faculty requirements because they simply are unable to find enough or attract enough adequately prepared or master's prepared nursing faculty. And with that, I'm going to turn it over to Judith, who is going to talk specifically about nursing faculty shortage.
Thank you. Before we go on,
yes.
Do any of the committee subcommittee members have any questions for Ms. Burke?
All right.
Thank you.
Hi. Good afternoon. My name is Judith Gedney Baggs, and I'm the Senior Associate Dean for Academic Affairs at Oregon Health and Science University. I'm located in Portland, but I have responsibilities across the state for all of our campuses. I was recruited to OHSU in 2005, so I'm new back to the region. I had spent 31 years in upstate New York, so I'm very glad to be back in the Northwest. And I'm here as a member both of the Oregon Council of Deans and the Oregon Nursing Leadership Council. I want to speak specifically today about the faculty shortage. You have heard, as Representative Greenlich has mentioned, everybody knows there's a nursing shortage at the hospital bedside in the delivery of care, but people are not often so well acquainted with issues related to the faculty shortage. In 2005, and I am going to give you a bunch of numbers, so in 2005, schools of nursing in the United States were unable to admit 150,000 qualified students to nursing educational programs because of shortages. 74% of schools said that a major reason for that inability to admit qualified students was related to lack of faculty. We will never be able to overcome the shortage of nurses at the bedside and delivering direct care unless we address the issue of the faculty shortage. In 2006, in the United States, there were almost 1,400 faculty vacancies that were identified. Nursing faculty members have the same aging problem that nurses and all of us do. The average age of doctorally prepared faculty in the United States is 55, of master's prepared, 54, and Karen told me this morning in Oregon that average age is 56 across all nursing faculty. So in that sense, we're a little worse off than other states in the country. For the most part, a master's degree is required to teach, and those of us who are teaching now are not going to be teaching forever. The average age at retirement for faculty members is 62 and a half. So a wave of faculty retirements is expected over the next decade. In Oregon, 15% of community college faculty and 23% of baccalaureate faculty are expected to retire in the next 5 years. By 2010, the estimate is that there will be 65 faculty positions in Oregon, and that those are only positions related to retirements. Those are not increased positions needed to bring on more students. One major problem for us in recruiting faculty is the salary that we're able to pay from the funds that we receive and then we raise ourselves. Dr. Joan Fitzgerald, who is director of the Graduate Program of Law, Policy, and Society at Northeastern, and I say that because she's not a nurse, she's an economist, so we listen to her more carefully, perhaps, than we might if you were hearing it from nursing, noted that the faculty shortage problem is mainly low pay for teachers of nursing. The average salary in the United States for a master's-prepared nurse practitioner in 2006 was over $72,000. For a master's-prepared faculty member, so essentially the same preparation, the average was $56,000. At OHSU, the salary differential means master's-prepared advanced practice nurses working in the hospital system on average make $30,000 a year more than we pay our faculty who are similarly prepared. Some examples of recent strategies that have been developed to combat the shortage outside of Oregon include a program in California that provides scholarships to students from underrepresented backgrounds who plan to become nursing faculty members. Independence Blue Cross Blue Shield in Philadelphia established a scholarship program for future nurse faculty members. There are federal faculty loan programs, and students can have 85% of the loan forgiven if they teach for 4 years after they finish their program. There's a newer program to nursing anyway called the Graduate Assistance in Needs Areas of National Needs that provides funding for doctoral students who plan to become faculty members. And OHSU has applied for those funds for next year. Dr. Fitzgerald, however, describes the federal programs as feeble and underfunded, noting that 82% of the applicants for loans and 94% for scholarships were rejected because there was inadequate funding, not because they were inadequate students. At OHSU, we have some new programs that will grow baccalaureate-prepared nurses, the foundation on which any education for a faculty member is built. These programs include OCNE, which you've heard a little about. And as someone who has come to Oregon from New York, and who's seen something of what the rest of the country is like, the collaboration that Judith talked about is totally remarkable in Oregon, and it's definitely worthy of support. In most of the country, community colleges and baccalaureate programs are not getting along at all. And the fact that they are in Oregon and are working together is very remarkable. So we also have a new accelerated baccalaureate program which will start in the fall, for students who have a bachelor's degree in another field. And that is actually older students are the most rapidly growing segment of new nursing students. Many of these nurses who earn a baccalaureate in nursing will provide direct care, but others will enter graduate education, become care providers as midwives or nurse practitioners or nurse anesthetists or clinical nurse specialists. Some of those will become faculty. We're also developing a new master's degree to start next fall in nursing education with a focus either on community health or on gerontology. Graduates of that program will be well prepared to teach at community colleges. Some graduates of both our master's programs will continue to get a doctorate and teach the more advanced students. These are our future faculty members. We take advantage of every program we can find. Central to this, but we need your assistance. And central to that assistance is your support of the Oregon Center for Nursing and its role as a clearinghouse for all aspects of the state's nursing profession. The nursing shortage is a critical issue for many with diverse professional interests, and we strongly believe that the diversity represented by the member organizations of the center allows solutions to meet the needs of all aspects of the nursing shortage. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony, and welcome to a place where it's much easier to shovel rain than snow. Any questions for Ms. Gedney-Baggs?
Yes, can I ask a question?
Yes, of course.
Well, first I want to make a comment that if you don't increase those faculty salaries at OHSU, the person on your left is going to point out they're in the wrong bargaining unit. but I do want to ask a question. I know you have an amazing program of distance learning, and I wonder how, and several of the community colleges are also getting very much involved in the distance learning thing. How is that affecting your need for faculty? Is that increasing or decreasing it?
I think a lot of people believe that if you do distance education, that one faculty member can take care of more students, but actually, sometimes those classes have to be smaller because there is more interaction. It may not be face-to-face in a classroom for 3 hours once a week, but it's continuous. And actually, if you let them, students will be expecting you to email them back at 2 o'clock in the morning. And nobody can sit in the back of the room and not participate because they're marked when they participate. And so all of the students have to be very participative. So it doesn't really decrease your need for faculty. The amount of distance education, however, with OCME is going to vastly increase because the community college students who matriculate into the OHSU program, either at the end of their second year in the community college or for their third year, will not come to one of our campuses. They will be staying on the community college campus, and we will be providing distance education to them.
May I have a totally irrelevant question?
Thank you. Yes, Representative Greenlick, you may.
I sit here and wonder why when you get a B.S. in nursing, it's referred to as a baccalaureate degree, and many other programs you've heard of as a bachelor's degree. Is there something magical in that?
You know, I can't answer that question for you. They are
words, I think.
Simultaneous.
Yeah.
They have the same meaning, a bachelor's or a baccalaureate.
Intriguing. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Oh, you're welcome, Representative Greenlick. I just want to say, at the risk of being anecdotal, I met a nurse in my district when I was out over the summer, and she said she would love to teach, and she thinks she'd be a great teacher, but she couldn't afford the pay cut. So I'm hearing that straight from the nurses,
right,
too.
Right.
So.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Thank you. All right. Ms. King, welcome back.
Thank you, Representative Bonamici and members of the committee. My name is Susan King, and I'm here today as a board member of the Oregon Center for Nursing. I'm also the executive director of the Oregon Nurses Association. I know you've been hearing a lot of acronyms that begin with O, starting with Oregon, of course. I just want to review for you which organizations are members, founding members of the Oregon Center for Nursing. We have the Oregon Nurses Association, the Board of Nursing, the Oregon Council of Deans, we all start with O, the Oregon Council of Community College Programs, and the Northwest One, although they started in Oregon, and that is nurse executives typically from hospitals and health systems. I want to build on very briefly what all of my colleagues have said, not to review sort of the ain't it awful story about the nursing shortage, but in my testimony I provided you with some statistics that I've lifted from the most recent report, which is in your packet, and that's When Not If. I do want to say that I'm very proud of the work of the nursing organizations in this state, and specifically the Center for Nursing. It's a little hard for us to sit here and pat ourselves on the back, but I do think that the collaboration and the ability to come together and try to work out a strategic plan that is good for the state, meets the needs of the statewide, and recognizes the differences across our state is really important. We have done that with the support of the Northwest Health Foundation as one of our biggest benefactors, and have appreciated and taken their support very seriously as we've done our work. A couple of things that I'd like to just tell you about what we've already accomplished. because my job here today is to give you a preview of what will be coming before either this committee or another committee ultimately, which is going to be a request for your investment, your further investment in the nursing workforce in the state. We have either been the instigators of or the planners of or the implementers of a number of programs. The OCNI, or the Nursing Consortium, actually was an idea that grew out of these five organizations. And we're very proud of the fact that those colleges that have chosen to work together are now have formed this consortium. The Oregon Center for Nursing has actually developed a product. It's called StudentMax, and it's a software program which matches students who need clinical placements with the clinical placements available. Right now, this is operating in the Portland metro area, but we certainly intend for it to be statewide. And interestingly, eight other states are going to purchase licenses for this program. What it does is it decreases the wear and tear, if you will, on the faculty to try to find clinical placements for their students. It also decreases the wear and tear on the clinical sites from having to respond to multiple schools of nursing. It tries to coordinate. Our latest statistics show that we have been able to increase the use of clinical sites by about 25% in the city of Portland, and that is really significant as we look at how can we educate more students. And as I said, we have other states with pending applicants applications to purchase our product. One statistic that I just learned last week, when we talk about our work around diversity, both in gender diversity and for among other underrepresented groups, within our student population in pre-licensure programs, our latest statistics appear to be, and these aren't yet ready to be carved in stone, appear that we have 21% who are men, which is really very dramatic. Nationwide, the percentage of men in registered nursing positions is about 6%. Oregon has always been a little bit higher, but 21% men in our nursing programs is really quite remarkable. You will notice a postcard, which is the poster that the Oregon Center for Nursing has put all over the state and now all over the country, which is entitled, Are You Man Enough to Be a Nurse? And that has certainly, we think, been part of the reason that we have been successful there. We have been working very diligently to provide the state, the nursing expertise, and policymakers such as yourselves with appropriate information and the latest and best thinking about what the status of the shortage is, what we expect the demand and need to be for the nursing profession in the future, and we have provided you, as I've said, in your packet with the reports that we have. So what about the future? First of all, I think it's important to recognize, as we've all talked today, we've very much been emphasizing sort of the recruitment end. What can we do to educate more nurses and entice people to consider nursing as a profession? What can we do to increase our enrollments in schools of nursing? We have increased our graduates over the last 5 years by about 45%, so that is significant. However, we need to recognize that retaining nursing professionals over the life of their career is just as important as bringing them in on the beginning of the career. And so the Center for Nursing, and working on our strategic plan, really comes together to look at what are all the factors that we need to consider as we deal with the nursing workforce over the next 10, 15, 20 years and beyond. So the strategic plan, which is our template for working on this issue in this state, will include other aspects of the nursing shortage, such as dealing with the practice setting, what kind of nursing leadership, mentors and supports, particularly the new nursing professionals as they enter their career. That is the most vulnerable group for exiting the profession, is within that first 2 or 3 years of licensure. We will be coming forward to you both with the good news, or more good news, to build on what I've given you a brief sample of today, with a proposal that asks you to make an investment. It will contain some elements that will, first of all, support the Center for Nursing. Those of us on the Center for Nursing Board promised the Northwest Health Foundation, when they began their work with us, that we would sustain our own funding at some point in the future. We have worked very hard on fundraising and on grant applications. We have even made a proposal to this legislature last legislative session for nurses to tax themselves to fund the center, which wouldn't be our first choice. We believe that the state's investment in the Center for Nursing will pay off. First of all, it'll pay off in terms of just bringing more in, but if we want to look at the economics of the state, the average wage of the RN population statewide last year was $61,000. So these are well, highly paid jobs, obviously contributing to the economic health of communities, not only to the health of the citizens of that community. We'll also be looking at some increased funding targeted for nursing faculty, which could include scholarships, could include grants, and it also could include stipends to bring salaries up to a level that will entice nurses perhaps away from direct patient care or perhaps part-time inpatient care and part-time in faculty positions. We will be looking for enhancements of an existing program, which doesn't get a lot of advertising, but it's actually a very beneficial program. It's the critical practice shortage area program, which has existed for about 15 years. And that program assists nurses, primarily those who have graduated, to repay student loans by practicing in critical practice shortage areas. Those can be geographic and those can be specialties. Faculty practice does qualify as one of those shortage areas. The Board of Nursing actually determines which those are, and we know on the horizon is the looming psych mental health nursing practice shortage, OR nursing, neonatal nursing has appeared on that as well. So we don't have a bill for you yet, but we definitely will be coming back to you, reminding you that we have taken our work very seriously, and with the collaboration that all of my colleagues have spoken to, have already begun to show you what outcomes we can produce for the state, and will hopefully secure your investment in further work. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Any questions?
I have a couple.
Okay, Representative Flores.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. King, a little bit about the Student Max. Is that online learning or on-site learning? And you indicate that there's a 25% increase in the use of clinical sites, so I'm just, whether it's physical facility or online. Mm-hmm. And then 9 states have purchased licenses for this product. So is it something that Student Max is a product, and did we develop it here in Oregon, and the proceeds from sales go into where?
I'll start with the last question first. Yes, it is a product that's developed through the Center for Nursing, and so the revenue does come into the Center for Nursing. So that's part of us trying to fund the work that we know needs to be done. This program is a software program that essentially coordinates the students and the clinical sites. So it isn't a teaching program. It helps track all of the places where students need to be for various clinical experiences. So, for example, St. Vincent's Hospital has 4 they can accommodate 4 students on the evening shift on a surgical unit. And we have 12 schools who all want those 4 slots. St. Vincent's has 4 available. Legacy Good Samaritan has 4 available. Emmanuel, et cetera. And so what we can do is we can pool all of those clinical requirements and pool the number of students that we need to place in those sites and match them, rather than having faculty from those schools spend half a day on the phone calling various hospitals and having students worry that they aren't going to be able to get the clinical rotation that they need. So it's a way to match clinical sites with the students who need them.
Follow up?
Yes.
Wow, what a wonderful program. What a step into the technology age, and to utilize that. And I think that's terrific. And I think you need to market it so that more than 9 states are buying into this.
We intend to. Thank you.
Questions, Representative Greenock? Thank you very much, all of you, for your testimony.
Thank you.
Forward to hearing more from you. Next is Camprys Braley, please. Brawley. I hope I pronounced it correctly. Welcome.
Thank you. Good afternoon. Thank you for the invitation. For the record, Cam Pori-Sprawley, Commissioner of Community Colleges and Director of the Department of Community Colleges and Workforce Development. I appreciate the invitation, and I'm thrilled to be in such wonderful company today. You all have your material. I think that you probably by now, since I've looked at your last several agendas, gotten a pretty good dose of the crisis and what the problem is, as defined from various different facets and segments. I'm just going to walk you through briefly some of the capacity problem at community colleges around the healthcare workforce shortage, which does, of course, include nursing. First, I want to start with the capacity problem. You have just heard about faculty. As I certainly talk with the community college professionals, they reiterate the need for additional capacity, but first they have to have faculty in order to have that capacity. The existing healthcare occupational programs that we have are fully enrolled. We currently accept between 10 and 25% of eligible applicants for the associate degree nurse, and between 20 and 30% of qualified applicants in other allied health programs. You see there certainly is a bottleneck in our capacity. Adding new programs in community colleges or anywhere is a lengthy, expensive, and fairly local process, and we have done much to bring together that local need and begin statewide programming so that the it doesn't have to be replicated in every community college, but rather can be done by a consortia of colleges similar to the OCNE effort that many of the community colleges are participating in. Just a little snapshot of history. In 2001, the Department of Community Colleges and Workforce Development had a budget note. And it read, the Oregon legislature charged community colleges to promote programs that train healthcare professionals, especially programs designed to expedite training and to accommodate student work schedules. End of quote. There was no resource for this. It was a directive. In 2002, the department, along with the community colleges, brought together a think tank of all 17 colleges to really work on this directive. How could we do it? From that, we established a public-private partnership that with the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems to really begin to dig into where were, and with agreement with the industry, where were the most critical shortages and how might we best deploy our resources to actually begin to marshal some response to that. That developed what has become known as CCHAP, another acronym, the Community College Healthcare Action Plan. What actions were we going to take collectively to be responsive? And I'll go through a couple of those responses in a moment. I have a couple of slides here. Slide three, certainly I saw that David Goldberg shared with you the shortages and had some discussion about that a couple of days ago. Slide number four, it gives you a picture of where the allied health programs are in community colleges across the state. We have very few community colleges that have nothing. We have a couple that have one, and most of their delivery is done either via distance learning or in partnership with a community college that's primarily in the I-5 corridor. Slide five, more data. Again, a slice of how many healthcare occupations or jobs are there going to need to be, and this calls out those particularly in rural areas. Community colleges do currently train 50% or better of the state's nurses and more than 75% of allied health workforce in the state. You've seen that list of the 17 highest need occupations already. slide six gives you just more of the dire, starting to sound like a dirge here, of what are we going to do about the impending, I think David Goldberg called it a perfect storm of many more people needing health services, far less people being prepared or in the workforce because of retirement or other things. So I'm moving on to slide six. So what's being done to respond? And I'm not going to take these in any particular order. I thought about doing them chronologically. I have already mentioned the Community College Healthcare Action Plan. That work continues today. It's funded with primarily federal professional technical resources that come to my office that we use for professional development of healthcare and allied healthcare programs. You have heard about the Oregon Consortium for Nursing Education. That dates back to, at least as far as I can tell, certainly in people's visions far before 2003, but it started to really gain traction then. Community colleges are an active partner there. The Simulation Alliance also began in 2003, providing equipment and distance learning so that we could ramp up the number of healthcare professionals in training and so they could have more opportunity for practicums.
Yes, Representative Braylock.
Could you explain that a little bit, please, about the simulation activities?
Well, yes, I will attempt. I'm sure there are others.
Judith,
yes, Judith, please. I mean, I could give you a rudimentary explanation, Judith, please.
Yeah, I'm happy to. The Oregon Simulation Alliance is a collection.
Excuse me, I think you need to reintroduce
yourself
for the record.
I'm sorry, Judith,
thank you very much.
Northwest Health Foundation.
Thank you.
The Oregon Simulation Alliance is a collective of sites and programs around the state that have developed simulation capability. And by that we mean high-tech simulation, particularly mannequins that represent patients. As technology has improved, initially nurses and other allied health professionals would train on mannequins that didn't really do anything. They were just kind of dummies, as they used to call them. The high-tech mannequins came into play about 5 or 6 years ago and have gotten progressively more and more sophisticated. And these mannequins ranged in the beginning from somewhere between $40,000 and $50,000 per mannequin. The price has come down over time, and part of what the alliance has done is developed bulk purchasing ability because of the alliance of a number of simulation centers across the state that are pooling resources to develop simulation scenarios. Each of the mannequins actually has to be scenarios have to be developed for the software itself so that the mannequin does what the trainers want it to do to act like a patient. The hope is that the opportunities for students who need a consistent opportunity to get skill development in certain situations, who might not otherwise get it because they're either in a rural area, they may never see a, in their practice or in their training, might not ever see a heart attack. You can mimic that, and you can teach the students in a practice setting before they ever get to real patients. And those mannequins are very effective. In fact, they have been designed over time from the airline industry, where has used simulation on a regular basis. And this is a great opportunity for the state to develop other kinds of training mechanisms. The important part of the alliance is that each of those sites, each of those laboratories could have been a great expense individually. What they were able to do was develop federal resources to come into the state and be dispersed to a number of different ones. I think there are something like 22 different simulation centers across the state that work in with community colleges, with hospitals and health systems and other institutions. EMTs train with them and others to use those simulations pretty much 24/7 for training.
So,
Does each school have a mannequin, at least one mannequin, or do they
share? No, they actually share them. The alliance, the benefit of the alliance was that they were placed in sort of population centers, and each of the projects would come together with a collaboration of health systems and the fire department and others, where they would guarantee basically they were going to use it together, but they would they always share it. There are some that are placed at community colleges. Some are placed at hospitals. It depends on each individual community what was the most appropriate placement. There's a very, very sophisticated high-tech simulation center that OHSU runs for the School of Nursing that's located in Portland.
Thank you.
Thank you.
She did that much better than I would have.
She did mention that federal dollars did help support the Simulation Alliance. We did receive $300,000 from the Department of Labor. The Governor's Workforce Investment Board also dedicated about $600,000 to building capacity, and the simulation was one piece of that across the state. They actually, in 2001, drafted a paper that really called attention to the workforce shortage in healthcare, and that became part of the workforce side's response to what do we do about this. The Department of Labor in 2005 granted the state of Oregon $2.9 million, which supports right now 10 regional projects across the state to continue this effort to build capacity. It is leveraged by $6.5 million of public and private partnership resources, and over 3 years, we anticipate that over 5,000 students will be served and over 1,500 industry-recognized credentials will be awarded through that grant. And last but certainly not least, the very first bullet on page 7 is the governor's recommended budget investments, and that nearly $30 million of partnership between OHSU, the university system, and community colleges to continue the expansion of capacity. And that takes me to slide 8. When I count up the outcomes that are expected in credentialed professionals for that investment in the governor's budget, it tops out at over 360. What other things we have done is that the community colleges, now 16 of 17, do provide allied health, science, and other prerequisite courses via distance learning. That has really helped, and we actually received a U.S. Department of Commerce grant to really look at what could we do next, what would be the next best steps we could take to amplify that network to increase its capacity. The DOL grants and other projects have really provided a wealth of lessons in how to do this and how to do it efficiently and effectively. And not on your sheet, but I quickly added as I was listening in the back, 9 of the 12 capital construction projects that are in the governor's recommended budget have some science, math, or a direct allied health and nursing capacity in them. So there is a recognition that we need capacity, both infrastructure capacity and human capital capacity. Last slide is just asking for your support of this public-private partnership that extends from the industry to the education sector to continue this investment. And we really do see it as an initial investment, but without it, we won't make the progress that we need to. So thank you very much.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Are there any questions for Commissioner Priest-Burling?
You talked about those 17, is it, occupations?
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. They range from things like mammography tech, phlebotomist, a variety of kinds of things. We're very worried about how to create rural health systems. And it's very clear, you and I had a chance to talk earlier today, if we have a little hospital in John Day or Baker City or Burns or whatever it is, it's going to be very hard to get that full range of personnel trained and certified. Is there any interest in the community college system of starting to do experiments on how to create personnel that can work across those kind of specialties? It just seems to me it's hopeless if we try to produce enough of every single one of those. And some of them seem, you know, a sonogram and a mammogram really aren't all that different in the kind of techniques people need to know how to do them. Maybe drawing blood is a little more complicated. But, we find we can train many people how to do that. What will it take to get some experiments going? Will it take some state professional regulation waivers? Will it take money? Will it take academic interest? We need to learn how to do things differently, not just more of the same.
Madam Chair, Representative Greenlee, you are speaking to a state administrator, not a healthcare specialist. What I've just heard you describe is a healthcare generalist, and I'm certain that, again, my colleagues that are here in the room would have certainly a better base of experience to answer your question about where it exists currently.
I don't think it exists anywhere currently.
I would say that I think that there are individuals that use an allied healthcare pathway and sort of stack up those credentials so that they can be moved from place to place or as they are needed. I don't know what might be the possibility of having a title generalist. I dare say it would take all of the things you talked about, a review of what's required by the boards that currently certify. It would take faculty interest. It would take money. It would take time. It would take a look at the regional economies to say where would these be most valued, who would be most interested in having them. So I'm sure scratching the surface of your question, but it certainly bears investigation.
It's sort of like a children's book we used to read, Are You My Mother? The duck is going around asking everybody. I'm asking this question of everybody I can think of, so don't imagine not to respond, because we need to begin to do something to change the way healthcare is delivered in some areas. I think that's all I have.
Thank you, Representative Greenlee. Thank you very much
for
your testimony. Next, we have Dr. James Mason.
Well, sitting on Cam, I might tell you, and Judith, that she has some things that I think might need some help from the foundation. I recommend she talk to Thomas, but perhaps she can talk to you and save us. Is there a phone call in Portland?
Welcome.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is James Mason, Office Administrator, Oregon DHS, Public Health Division, Office of Multicultural Health. And I'm addressing some of the other healthcare workforce issues. And I'd be somewhat remiss if I didn't say that with respect to public health, our client is the entire state. And I would start there. And as I address these issues, I would also be need to say that many of these occur both at the state and local level when we're thinking about our workforce development issues. I would probably start with describing some of the drivers for workforce development. And we heard a lot of them addressed already by some of my colleagues and people I've had an opportunity to work with. But one of our primary drivers has to do with the DHS core values, where respect for diversity is one of the primary values of DHS. And we have to find ways to operationalize that value and give life to that value. We have it in much of our rhetoric, and we're trying to live up to that as our most public health employees around the nation. And we think we are making progress. The second major driver that we've found is the business case. Among the ones that I subscribe to are some of the things coming out of the University of Michigan School of Business that talk about the benefits that accrue to end users as a result of having a diversified workforce. Some of them may include improving problem identification and solving, increasing creativity, innovation, and productivity, increasing organizational flexibility and workforce appeal. So as we become more diverse as a public health entity, the ability to attract the best and brightest of the diverse communities becomes easier. It also allows us to improve recruitment and retention as a result of this previously mentioned critical mass. It enhances resource acquisition and development, improves outreach, and ultimately strengthens organizational efficiency. One of the things that has been fairly well documented that as workforces attempt to diversify, some of the growing pains and some of the conflicts that occur when workers leave as a result of conflict, we spend about one-third of their salary in the rehiring process. So as we think about diversity in and of itself, it isn't a good or bad thing, but managing it is critical. So the business case is becoming more and more a driver. The third driver for us was the Governance, Racial, and Ethic Health Task Force of the year 2000, where one of the major recommendations was to create a mechanism for attracting and employing culturally and linguistically competent workforce. It was recommended that DHS make a concerted effort to recruit, retain, and promote culturally diverse workers, including racial and ethnic minorities as well as linguistic minorities. And again, that's a challenge, but not only for Oregon. I think it's a challenge for all of us in the room and certainly a challenge for all of us in the country. With respect to the major activities that my office has engaged in over the 2005-2007 time period that we think is going to contribute to the diversity of the public health workforce, both in local and statewide situations. One is where we're very proud to mention that we're one of the first states to develop the development of a healthcare interpreter certification process. We passed an administrative rule last year where we will be looking to qualify and certify competent healthcare interpreters. Most of our preliminary documents are with respect to Spanish, but there will be four or five other major language groups that we'll be wrestling with here in the state of Oregon. We continue to do health disparity community outreach and community education. Over the last 2 years, we've convened 36 community outreach and education activities in geographically diverse areas of the state. So a big part of what we do is almost become cheerleaders in championing the mission of, as mentioned before, of the community colleges, of some of the four-year schools, and just recognizing the medically underserved areas across the state of Oregon. We've also engaged in considerable amount of cultural competence training and workforce development activities. I think over the past 2 years, we've trained over 2,000 health workers in the state of Oregon, which we're very proud of. Most of our evaluations have been pretty sterling, which sounds immodest, but we've done a fairly decent job with respect to that. And the fourth major area for us is to enhance our ability to collect racial and ethnic data and data around diverse social groups, recognizing that there's supreme amount of diversity within any racial or social category, and we want to not learn to exchange new stereotypes for old stereotypes. With respect to DHS, we have other activities and resources that we think will enhance workforce development and diversity in public health. One is the DHS Human Resources Department has recently hired a recruiter who has several staff people that venture around the state looking for opportunities to diversify the workforce, certainly at the state level, but we think it's going to have benefits for the local health departments as well. The DHS Training Office is looking to provide overarching cultural competency training, but also looking to devise training that's specific to public health. We have the DHS Diversity Development Coordinating Council that also conducts a lot of training and community cultural awareness activities. And lastly, as a resource to DHS, we have the Oregon Promise Internship Program, where we are able to, I would argue, recruit among the best and brightest of Oregon's graduates. In fact, is of the five employees in my office, three are Promise interns that we're able to get actually get our hooks into and retain for some time. And they've done a remarkable job. So I just wanted to share that with you today as one of the other healthcare workforce issues that we think are facing Oregon. I would very much endorse the previous testimony and was proud to hear my colleagues do such a good job. And that would be my testimony for today.
Thank you very much for bringing those important issues to us. Are there any questions? Representative Greenlee?
Thank you very much. You focus on the public health workforce. Do you also focus on the healthcare workforce? I mean, like in your statistics and things, do we know how many, what the ethnic and racial distribution of nurses and LPNs? And
I could tell you that.
Demographers and?
No, we don't. Madam Chair, Representative Greenlee, no, we don't. Our HR department, Human Resources Department, has just recently started to collect that kind of data for the Public Health Department. With respect to healthcare programs, there isn't a standard approach to collecting that type of data around just something as seemingly mundane as race and ethnicity. And I would argue that as a society, we'll be struggling with that for some time. I mentioned earlier that we are trying to help both public and private healthcare providers identify better practices toward racial and ethnic data collection, but we're probably years away from coming to closure with that activity.
But that is in your scope of.
Absolutely.
Thank you. I have a question about the Promise Intern Program. Is that college students, high school students?
Madam Chair, it's college students, both undergraduate and graduate. We've had, for the most part, undergraduate students who are interested in public health, and it helps jumpstart their career. We've also just began to recruit graduate students who come to us and give us added human resource for a modicum amount of money. So we think it's a very cost-effective way of both enhancing the Office of Multicultural Health, but also a way of giving an injection of youth and vitality into public health generally.
Thank you. I appreciate that. And I'll point out something I brought up earlier, I guess, in the week about high school students and how it's important, I think, to reach out and get students at that age interested as well. And I know the Beaverton School District, for example, which is in my district, has a new medical magnet, high school. And places like that, I think, are good places to go out and reach out to get students interested at that young age as well. So thank you again for being here.
My pleasure.
The racial and ethnic diversity of Beaverton School District among the most diverse in the state.
It is very diverse.
Yeah.
Thank you, and unless there's anybody else here to testify, I will now close the informational meeting. And unless there's an objection, I will adjourn the meeting of this subcommittee of the subcommittee.
Just wanted to make an announcement.
Oh, yes, I do want to make an announcement that there's no meeting on Tuesday,
right?
February 6th. And yes?
Was someone else who wanted to speak?
Oh, oh. All right. So please come forward.
Oh, thank you.
I'm sorry, I apologize, my name wasn't on the list.
Okay, just a moment, please. I will reopen the informational meeting of the subcommittee of the Subcommittee on Healthcare Policy. And please state your name for the record.
Why isn't it just
because
like
we don't have a quorum.
Yes, we do. I counted the quorum.
Well, we did. Well, not when she gaveled in originally, sir. But that's okay.
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Okay. My name is Maria Elena Reese. I'm a nurse, and I'm a nurse practitioner. I'm PhD prepared. I'm a faculty at OHSU with the Center for Health Disparities and the Oregon MPH program. I'm here on behalf as a representative of the National Organization of Hispanic Nurses, where I was on the board until last year, and I'm a member of the Oregon chapter of National Association of Hispanic Nurses, commonly known as NAHNS. I'm here in support of the Oregon Center for Nursing with my colleagues and also with Dr. James Mason, who's been very supportive since I moved here from Los Angeles. Approximately 2.5 years ago, I was one of those people recruited under the Oregon program. And what I bring is that I am an RN. I am Latina, a bicultural bilingual. I speak and read Spanish. And I'm PhD prepared, and I'll give you a few statistics about nursing workforce and the diversity, because that is the issue that several organizations are very interested in. So for one, there's approximately 38,500 nurses in Oregon, about 38.5. 93% of them identified themselves as white origin, 93%. This is in contrast to 87% in the U.S. So the ratio, the proportion of nurses who would identify themselves as white, Caucasian, in Oregon is much higher than nationwide. Okay. Approximately in Oregon, 1% of all the nurses identify themselves as Hispanic, Latino background in Oregon. That's in contrast to the U.S. of 2%. What's interesting is that when I became a nurse in the late 1970s, the percentage of Hispanic nurses in the U.S. was approximately 5%. So it has gone down substantially. Black nurses in Oregon, approximately 1%. In the U.S., it's 5%. Asians in Oregon, Asian origin nurses in Oregon, less than 1%. In the U.S., 3%. Native American, Pacific Islander, no data on that in Oregon or in the U.S. So demographically, Oregon is doing a little, or it's a little less successful than throughout the U.S. What's interesting is that I brought some articles, and I guess I read a lot, but in today's Oregonian, it talks about the demographic shifts of the Latinos and in the schools, so that one out of every six students in Oregon is now Latino background, predominantly in the kindergarten through high school, one out of every six, and it's a very young population. In contrast to the aging and the graying of America, we have the young. And in California, they call it the browning of California. That may be what's happening in Oregon, too, as in many other states. So it's one out of every six. Now, a couple of days ago in the LA Times, there was an article about Latino college students and what they term cultural aversion to loans. So that they're finding that there's more and more Latinos, as myself, who took longer to go to college, who took longer than 4 years. Maybe the average is around 6 to 7 years to get a bachelor's, if we do get a bachelor's. We stay in college and graduate. So that it takes longer, and there's still an aversion, even though they work. They go to school and they work, but they don't want those loans, and so it takes longer, or they may drop out and come back. So that is happening in California. Then in the New York Times over the weekend, there was an article about the vaccine that they're proposing for human papillomavirus to protect some women against cancer, the risk of cancer. And what came out is the price, of course, of the vaccine, but also will families of diverse background accept this, because they are proposing that girls as young as 12 get this. The point is not about the vaccine. The point is about the diversity and how to propose this to families, because families of diverse backgrounds, racial, ethnic backgrounds, may have different values and beliefs about illness and about sickness and protection and health promotion. And that is where diversity comes into play. That is what drew me from California to Oregon, the ability to work at the public health centers, the ability to do research and work as a clinician with diverse populations and the change in demographics here. So why is this all important apart from that? Well, I cannot speak for all minorities, and I cannot speak for all racial ethnic groups, but I am very familiar with Latino culture, because I was born in Mexico and grew back and forth between border states until I stayed in California and then came over here. My parents had less than a second grade education, and six children, all of us went to college. One ended up, my sister was a vice principal in a high school. So I became a nurse, a clinician, and a researcher now. And so my focus is working with Latinos and mentoring students. So Hispanic Nurses provides this. Not only Hispanic Nurses, but with any other organization that works with diverse groups. And so we offer our services, and we say that it is time we embrace diversity, and we bring those organizations that are out in the communities that have strong professionals out there that identify with the communities and represent the communities, and we are here to support these measures.
Thank you very much. Are there any questions? Representative Greenlee?
Thank you.
Thank you again for your testimony.
Thank you.
Right, and I will now close the informational meeting. And without objection, I will adjourn the meeting.